right, guys, you are locked on Falcons, and I'm your host, Aaron Freeman. Today, we are wrapping up the Falcons news as they completed their coaching staff. I'm going to talk a little bit about a recent mock draft I posted on LockedOnFalcons.com, and I will also be answering maybe one or two listener questions as well.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So, you guys know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon fan sites on the internet, at FalFans, tweeting up a storm, tweeting all those hot takes out there, and also the host of this illustrious podcast. So, guys, I'm back after a brief hiatus. Been dealing with some laryngitis. I couldn't even talk at all on Sunday, the day I originally wanted to do this podcast, but I'm feeling a little bit better. But so if my voice sounds weird and scratchy and hoarse and you hear me wheezing and coughing, it's because I can't talk and I'm sacrificing my throat. That sounds so weird. I'm sacrificing my voice for you, the people. You know, that was a bad Bane impression. But if my voice sounds like it's going to get squeaky at times because my larynx is all messed up. But so today's episode, I want to wrap up the coaching news. The Falcons essentially finalized their coaching staff. I want to touch upon that. I posted a 7-round mock draft for the Falcons on LockedOnFalcons.com. I wanted to explain a little bit of the methodology, why I picked certain players, talk about that for 15 or 20 minutes, and then maybe, you know, wrap up this podcast by getting to a couple of your listener questions. I don't want to promise that. I know I said it in the intro, but I'll try to get to at least one. And so if this thing is running longer than I expected it to, I'll make an effort to not ramble as much. So let's get things started. Okay, guys, so the Falcons were able to finalize their coaching staff. They found a replacement for Keith Carter. You guys remember on a previous episode, I guess that was 2 weeks ago, I talked about some possible replacements, some guys that the Falcons might, that were out of the league coaching last year that Dan Quinn had some previous connections to that he might hire there. They did not hire either of those guys. They wound up hiring former Oakland Raiders assistant coach, but he also played in the league in Miami prominently, I think, as well with the Jets, and Bernie Parmalee to be their replacement for Keith Carter at that running back position. Decent hire. As I've said many times on this podcast, I don't obsess with assistant coaches as to the degree that some fans do. You know, I just, the reason, quickly to explain the reason for that, and I should note, I'm differentiating position coaches from coordinators. There's a difference between those guys. But position coaches, 99.9% of what they do happens during the week and doesn't necessarily happen on game day. And so we don't, because we're not at practice and we're not in those film rooms and those position meetings for hours upon end, we aren't privy to 99% of what position coaches do. So to sit here and judge simply because you don't like or you do like the product that you're seeing on Sunday, you know, it's just kind of silly to me. But that's one of the reasons why I don't tend to spend too much time assessing about position coaches. So is Bernie Parmalee a good hire? Sure. Would the Falcons have hired pretty much anybody for this job? You know, Bob that lives down the street, when I would have said this is a good hire, I'd been like, yeah, you know, Bob does a decent job cutting his grass. So let's see if he can, you know, figure out how to coach Devontae Freeman. I don't know. I'm rambling. So they also hired Meyer Chaudhary, I think that's how you announce it, to replace Eric Satulovich as the assistant special teams coach. We talked quite a bit over the last couple of months about sort of if Keith Armstrong was on the hot seat. I know some within our fan base think he should be. I don't quite adhere to that. I certainly think there's some valid criticisms to some of the decisions that were made on special teams, but I think that's not enough to fire a guy just because I don't like who the gunner is, or I didn't like that Andre Roberts took that kickoff out of the end zone 7 yards deep. Like, I don't understand why you would fire the coach for that. But, you know, presumably, whether Satulovich's contract was up, whether he was actually fired, whether he was let go so he could seek other opportunities, according to Von McClure, he was interviewing for an open position at Mississippi State. So who knows? But considering sort of all the talk about changes need to be made in special teams, you could you know, could put two and two together and say that he was sort of the scapegoat. Fair or unfair, who knows? Again, we don't know because he's a position coach. But, you know, he was basically the scapegoat for the issues on special teams. And so they brought in Chidowry from, I forget what school he was at, but I want to say some school out west. I want to say like Oregon or something like that, or Rutgers. I know Rutgers is not out west, but for some reason that's the school in my head. Who knows? So they brought back Chad Walker, who was with Arkansas last year as a linebackers coach. He was their defensive assistant prior to. He's now going to be their offensive assistant to replace Charlie West Jr., who's now the offensive coordinator at Florida Atlantic. I believe that's Lane Kiffin School, if I'm not mistaken. Chad Walker, basically Arkansas hired a new head coach in Chad Morris, formerly the Clemson offensive coordinator. So they cleaned house, and so Walker became available, and it made perfect sense to switch him back to from defense to offense, I think. And obviously, we hired Greg Knapp earlier to replace Bush Hamden, who's now the offensive coordinator at University of Washington. So when you sit there and talk about, you know, all these people that Matt Ryan has been coached by are now offensive coordinators, I guess you can throw Bush Hamden into that tree as well. So that's the Falcons coaching staff. There's not a whole lot else I need to add to that again, because I'm not going to sit here and parse through assistant coaches and be like, this is an intriguing hire because this, you know, whatever. I don't care about that stuff. So we'll see how it goes. Hopefully, you know, it really boils down to Sark doing a better job. He's certainly capable of doing that. We've talked about that a ton. As I've said a million times, I'm skeptical to how much improvement he'll show this year. I think there will be improvement, but whether or not we go from the 15th best scoring offense to the 12th best scoring offense or the 8th best scoring offense or the 5th best scoring offense or better than that, who knows? At this point, it's pure speculating and guessing at this point. And certainly there's no reason to look at any of these individual coaching hires and be like, oh, this is going to be the difference. He alone is going, you know, Greg Knapp as an offensive coordinator, consistently his teams were below average offenses. So I don't necessarily know if I can say, oh, because we hired Greg Knapp, suddenly our offense is going to blossom. It could, and it could be attributed to Greg Knapp. Historically speaking, he's been a really good quarterback's coach. And I've, you know, my sort of excuse when it comes to position coaches, unless I read articles that specifically cite a player or another coach saying this coach is good at X, Y, and Z, which I've seen with Greg Knapp and from his past experience as the Falcons offensive coordinator, I know certain things that he's good at. I can say that those are his strengths. So he's a good quarterback's coach. I know as an offensive coordinator, he wasn't great at building great prolific passing offenses. But the one thing I can say attest to Greg Knapp during his time, whether it was in Atlanta or elsewhere, he's very good at juggling multi-headed backfields. And so maybe that'll be something that will help with Sark doing that better. And so maybe the running game could be a little bit more efficient than it was, and maybe that'll lead to better success elsewhere in the offense. Who knows? Again, all speculation at this point in time. Who knows what happens? We'll find out. We'll talk about it certainly when we get to training camp. We'll certainly talk about it this summer after the draft and whatnot. But until then, all speculation. So let's move on and talk about the mock draft. But because we're about to talk about the draft, I do have to remind you guys that you guys need to be listening to Locked On NFL Draft with hosts John Ledger and Trevor Sikkema. They're going to be at the Combine this year, in addition to our good friend Charles McDonald. You definitely want to check out that podcast in the upcoming weeks to get all the latest on what's going on in the Combine in the lead up to this 2018 draft. So go ahead, subscribe to Locked On NFL Draft, wherever podcasts can be found now, including Spotify. So let's talk about my mock draft. If you didn't check out it on LockedOnFalcons.com, I suggest you pause this podcast. You know, if you're driving in the car, you know, don't look at your phone while you're driving. But when you get to a destination, you can pull it up on your phone. Or if you're at work, you know, sneak away from those TPS reports and go out and check it out. Pause me and come back. Look at it. Do a quick scan and come back and we'll talk about it. So let's talk about it. And you know, looking at my mock draft, I don't want to sit here and bore you with the details, but I do want to talk a little bit about the methodology behind this mock draft. I do want to give you guys my philosophy about mock drafts in general. They are highly inaccurate. And while I do think mock drafts are fun to do, I think it's always fun to go through the permutations of how a draft may or may not go. And if they draft, they pick this guy, who's going to be here and what are they, you know, that stuff is fun to me. And it's certainly, I think it's a big reason why, you know, if I can, you know, gloat a little bit and toot my own horn a little bit. Back in the day, I used to work for this site called The Huddle Report, which you guys may know as the site that grades mock drafts. Is most famous for grading mock drafts. And I used to do team needs and free agency stuff for that website many, many years ago. I think that stopped around 2011 or 2012, if I'm not mistaken. But, and part of the reason why I love doing these mock drafts is going through these teams and looking at these teams' roster and be like, oh, they're weak here and they're doing all this sort of things and going through all the different permutations. So I think mock drafts are fun, but I think people put way too much stock in them, particularly this early in the process. Mock drafts don't even come close to being accurate, and they're not accurate at all. They're like the best mock draft is only going to be about 25% accurate when assessing the accuracy of selecting players in the first round. But even now, it's just kind of it's purely guessing before free agency, before the combine, any of that stuff. And so, my anti mock draftness is I get baffled by people talking about the draft in February and in January and in December as well, as if they have a clue what's going to happen. They have no clue what's going to happen. There's so much stuff that needs to happen before that. You know, the analogy I always use is like talking about the draft in terms of what is going to happen today is like talking about who you're going to root for in the Super Bowl in like week four of the regular season. Right, you can sit there and say, hey, based off of the first four games of the season, this team looks like a Super Bowl team. Like you would have said that about who? Kansas City and Philadelphia this past season? And by week four, who were the best teams in the NFL? Yeah, we would have said the Super Bowl would have been Kansas City and Philadelphia. Now, the Philadelphia prediction may have wound up being true in the end, but not simply because of what you saw in the first 4 weeks. As we saw, what happened in the last 4 weeks of the regular season had way more impact on the Eagles Super Bowl run with Carson Wentz getting hurt. And then we saw Kansas City completely drop off the map basically after that point. So that's the point I want to get across. So when you see me go on these anti-mock draft rants, it's not because I hate mock drafts. It's just I hate the sort of sense of entitlement that it seems like that people talk about mock drafts, particularly at this point in the calendar year, and the obsession that people have with criticizing these mock drafts. So the point of me doing these mock drafts, and particularly these early mock drafts that I'm going to be doing a couple of times between now and the draft, doing these seven-round mocks where I project all seven rounds of the Falcons picks, particularly early on, is going to be me sort of throwing more permutations at it rather than actual doing, you know, this is what I think is actually going to happen. There is an element of here's a realistic scenario or a semi-realistic scenario. But it's not necessarily like, take this as an authority of me doing an accurate prediction. Now, if this mock winds up being accurate, then I will certainly, come April, claim my clairvoyancy and my prophetic skills, certainly, as one is supposed to do when you make a guess and it actually becomes true, as it has become my brand over the last couple of years. But, you know, take this stuff with a grain of salt is basically what I'm saying to say. So with this first mock draft and probably the next couple of mock drafts, I probably won't have the Falcons taking a defensive tackle in the first round. Just because even though right now, if you ask me to put money on it, do I think the Falcons are going to take a defensive tackle in the first round? I'd probably say yes. But as at the same time, I do want to get people's juices flowing in terms of the thought processes of thinking about the draft as not simply being first round D tackle, second round guard. Like I think too much of people's looking at the draft is based purely off of let's rank the needs in order of priority and then let's draft players at those positions based off of the corresponding round. So highest priority, if that's D tackle, then that's first round. Second priority is guard, that's second round. Third priority is, you know, in a lot of fans' opinions, which is baffling to me, tight end. Then that's a third round pick. And I think that's the wrong way to approach the draft. That's not how teams approach it. No, certain teams may do actually approach it that way, and those are teams that draft poorly. But it's really about the value of the individual player. And specifically, the person I had selected in the first round of the Falcons is Isaiah Wynn, the Georgia guard. We talked about him on a recent episode with Charles McDonald. We're probably going to talk about him quite a bit in the coming weeks, but spoiler alert, I think in terms of the zone blocking guard, Isaiah Wynn is a top 10 talent. For this Falcon scheme, he is a top 10 talent. I think that highly of him. Watching his progression from his junior year to his senior year, he is so much better. The balance, the poise, the footwork, the technique, all those sorts of things. The only knocks on him are that he's too short, he's too light, and he has small hands, right? Those are the knocks on him. It's not the physical gifts. I'm curious to how he'll test. I don't think he's going to blow up the combine and be like one of the greatest athletes ever that we've ever seen at the guard position. I don't think that stuff really matters, but I do think he'll test well, particularly in the agility sort of things, you know, above average or whatever it is. And that's all he really needs to do. As long as he's not in the 20th percentile in some of these areas, we'll be good to go there. So I think he's a perfect fit for this Falcon team. I think if he's there on the draft board at this point in time, based off of what I've seen at the D-tackle position, I think he's better than most of these D-tackles that are being projected in the first round as potential Falcons targets, like Mo Hurst and Deron Payne and Taven Bryan and Vita Vea and Harrison Phillips. I think Mo Hurst, from what I've seen, is the only guy that I might argue is a top 10 talent, given the Falcons need. Again, not as a top 10 talent league-wide, but a top 10 talent given where the Falcons' positional needs are and how their board will stack, because again, the Falcons aren't going to be looking at any of these five quarterbacks. They're not going to be looking at offensive tackles. They're not going to be looking at certain position groups, including wide receiver and running back and all that type of stuff. But in terms of what I'm looking at, I think Gwynn is better than some of these D-tackles. Not to knock these D-tackles, I think they're good. I think most of these guys are legit first-round talents, and I would have no problem with the Falcons taking them in the draft. But I don't think the Falcons need a D-tack. I think it's a big need, don't get me wrong. And I certainly think the Falcons need to address their interior pass rush. So I'm not trying to dismiss that as it's not that big a deal. But I don't look at some of these guys, like a guy like Vea. I don't think he's that good of a pass rusher to really be like, we have to get him if he's there. Deron Payne, outside of the national championship game, I didn't look at him as a great pass rusher. Like, he dominated the national championship game, and that's going to cause me to go back and take a deeper look at more of his film. But prior to that, looking at him, I was like, yeah, he's okay. You know, he's not a prolific pass rusher, so I don't see he's just once in a, you know, this sort of, like, we have to get this pass rusher. Bryan, I think, has a tremendous upside, but I think he's raw enough where it's like he's probably going to take the better part of 3 or 4 years to hit that level. And so I think Wynn is a guy that can come in day one and be an upgrade on that offensive line. Hurst is the only guy that I think could be a day one impact pass rusher for this team potentially. But then again, when I watch Hurst, I like him. I like him a lot. But I didn't absolutely fall in love with Maurice Hurst like I would fall in love with an Aaron Donald, or like I fell in love with a Sheldon Rankins, or like I fell in love with a Fletcher Cox, and those types of guys that to me were legit like top 10, top 15 talents as pass rushers. Now, again, I got to revisit more Mo Hurst tape in order to really, and I may come away weeks from now saying a completely different tune. Again, this is a process. We're in February. Don't pay any attention to any of my draft takes until we get to April. But that's my thought process right now. And I think when at this point in time, not to say that he should be the Falcons pick or he will be the Falcons pick, but like in terms of talking about this D-tackle crop, and we'll touch upon this in a little bit, but in terms of this D-tackle crop, I think it's so deep a D-tackle class, particularly relative to last year. It may not be as good as 2016's D-tackle class, but I think it's so many good available D-tackles that are going to be available in day two and in early part of day three that I don't feel like the Falcons have to feel like, man, we got to take this D-tackle. And I think if a guy like Wynn is there, even though I don't think guard is a massive, massive need, I think the Falcons, I've said many times that I think the Falcons can go into next year with the same five starting offensive linemen and probably, you know, with the exception of Sam Brailo, most of the remaining backups as their guys and be just fine. But I think Wynn is so good and so such a perfect fit for what the Falcons do that to me he's the exception to the rule. And that's really what you're looking for in my draft philosophy. And we'll certainly be talking about that more in the coming months. My philosophy is, who are the exceptions and who are the special players in that way? Who are the guys that really stand out as a, this guy stands out in comparison to past years? And like, to me, I have Wynn higher than I have Lamp or Dan Feeney and the guys that we talked about as potential first round targets last year. I think he's better than those guys. I think he's much more, you know, you don't have necessarily the height weight type of stuff, but I think from a technique standpoint, he's right up there. I was high on Forrest Lamp too. I don't want to sound like I was down on him, but I didn't see him as like this world changing talent. But like when I know, like in terms of technical stuff, like he reminds me a lot of Zach Martin. And I'm not saying he's going to be Zach Martin, but just like the feeling I had from like, this guy is so clean and so crisp and so under control. Like the last time I felt that way about an offensive lineman was Tunsil and Zach Martin. And those two guys to me, generational may be thrown around a bit too much. And maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit when I say generational. But Tunsil was generational in terms of tackle, or at least generational in the sense of the 3 years prior to him and probably the 3 years after him. I haven't seen an offensive tackle as good as Laremy Tunsil, in my opinion. And Zach Martin was the rare sort of guard, you know, better than Warmack, better than Cooper. I'm rambling, I know. Cooper is a good comparison for Wynn. And I know Cooper kind of busted out in Arizona and is only now sort of reclaiming himself as a competent mid-level starter in Dallas this past year. But Cooper was a top 10 pick in, what, 2013 or 2014, if I'm not mistaken. I guess it had to be 2013. To me, Isaiah Wynn is the player that we thought Jonathan Cooper was going to be. You know what I'm saying? Like the player that everybody sat there and said, yeah, Cooper is this rare top 10 talent as an offensive guard. That to me is the type, I feel the same way about Isaiah Wynn. And I'm optimistic, hopeful, as much as I can be, that he'll live up to that billing that Cooper did not. Could be wrong about that in a similar way that I was about Cooper, because I was very high on Cooper. But yeah, so that's how I feel about Isaiah Wynn. So, we'll see what happens in the combine, you know, and if he tests poorly, and it, like again, like 20th percentile type of stuff, and a lot of the agility and explosive stuff, then I might have to be like, okay, maybe he is just going to be another Jonathan Cooper. But I do, watching him on film, watching him as a junior, he was kind of iffy in a lot of the games I saw, but the growth he's shown in terms of how much improvement he's on the nuances of the position to me has been tremendous. And that's a testament to the Georgia coaching staff. And I don't think that's a fluke. I don't think that's an illusion. And so I'm expecting him, you know, that to me tells coachability, and that tells me this guy can be developed. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm high on it. But let's move on. All right, guys, you may not be aware of this, but there is now Locked On MLB. The baseball is now bringing into the Locked On Podcast Network, and they're starting to expand their shows. I don't believe there's a Locked On Braves yet for you Atlanta natives, but if you happen to support another MLB team, then you might be able to check out your favorite team on the Locked On MLB Network, wherever podcasts can be found. All right, so let's wrap up. I'm running longer than I wanted on this mock draft because I'm spending too much time. But Nate Shepard was my second round pick. Shepard is a guy that tore up the Senior Bowl. Arguably, some people said he was the best D tackle at the Senior Bowl. We know the Falcons love competitiveness. And that's part of the reason my methodology with picking this. I had 7 picks for the Falcons. I was factoring in a 7th round compensatory pick based off of over the cap's projections. So the Falcons wound up with 7 picks. And 6 of my 7 picks wound up being guys that I had that were in the various All-Star games, looking at the Senior Bowl, looking at the East-West Shrine game in particular. And we've known, and this will be something that I will write explicitly on LockedOnFalcons.com probably next week in terms of focusing on the combine. But we've talked about sort of what the Falcons look at, not just in the combine, but in terms of their draft prospects. And out of the 19 picks that the Falcons have had, 5 of those guys were underclassmen, so they weren't in All-Star games. But of the other 14 guys, 11 of those 14 did participate in one of the All-Star games, whether that was the Medal of Honor Bowl, the NFLPA Bowl, the East-West Shrine Game, or the Senior Bowl. And the three that weren't were Vic Beasley, who declined the Senior Bowl, Tack McKinley, who declined because he was hurt, and Wes Schweitzer because he wasn't invited. But Wes Schweitzer is the exception, to, as I said on the recent episode with Charles, because Keith Carter, who's now no longer with the Falcons, coached him while he was at San Jose State. So he personally knew, could speak to the competitiveness. And that's why the Falcons love these All-Star game guys, because we know Dan Quinn talks about the competitiveness. He loves competitiveness. And being able to go to these All-Star games and watching these guys practice for 2 to 3 days or whatnot does say a lot about their competitors. You can see firsthand how competitive these guys, how hard they work in practice. And that's something that Dan Quinn fosters a lot. And that's why the Falcons focus so much on, you know, 80% of their senior prospects that they've drafted have been, you know, All-Star games. And so when I was looking at doing my mock, and that's probably something I will continue to do, but in future mock drafts that I'll do, I'll try to switch it up and get different guys that may or may not fit the Falcons, particularly once we get after the combine and we see some of these athletic tests and see some of these guys test better. But that was one of the, that was a concerted effort I made, and Shepard was certainly one of those guys. The biggest knock on Shepard is he went to a small school, which I don't think really matters all that much, but he's also going to be 25 years old. And that's pretty old, and that typically dings guys as a rookie. But I do think he is going to be in the mix for the second round range. I think we know kind of who the top five, consensus at least, top five D tackles who I mentioned earlier are going to be in this class. But really it's going to be the guys like 6 through 15 that are going to be in the day two range and how they stack the board. I think the combine is going to help us really differentiate these guys. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think this class is deep, and we'll see how the combine sort of might push certain guys more into the late third, fourth round range, and some of these guys into the high second, mid second round range. But you have guys like Nathan Shepard, Derek Nnadi. I won't name them all. That's just going to drag on the podcast too. We'll talk about them. We'll definitely get to a bunch of these guys. But Shepard is one of those guys that I think has that pass rush potential, similar to a Taven Bryant with the size and length and whatnot. That could be a guy that the Falcons really do fall in love with. Third round pick was Quentin Meeks. He's an underclassman, a cornerback, son of former Carolina Panthers defensive coordinator Ron Meeks, coach's son. NFL teams always love coaches' sons. You know, went to Stanford, tall guy, smart. I'm going to be curious how he tests. I think the one knock watching him on film is maybe he doesn't have that long speed. And so, you know, if he can sort of clock a 4.55 or lower, that's going to be good for him. Anything above that, that's going to be problematic. But I have him go in the third round for the Falcons. I think that's probably a good value at this point. Again, a fast 40, I think, could push him significantly up in that second round range. A slower one, you know, then we're talking late third round, maybe fourth round even as well. So he's a good fit for the Falcons. I think the Falcons need to get a big corner this year. The thing I mentioned on LockedOnFalcons.com was, given you got guys like Michael Thomas and Mike Evans and Devin Funchess in the NFC South, all 6'3 or taller receivers, two of those guys are 6'5, you need to have some size at the position, particularly after Brian Poole. We talked quite a bit about Brian Poole and whether or not he's the ideal nickel cornerback. But the bottom line is, if Alford and or Trufant get hurt, and you go into a 5'9 Brian Poole, and he's going to be asked to cover one of these guys, all of a sudden you're going to rapidly shift your entire defensive scheme, because now all of a sudden you're going to have to shadow, because you're not going to put Brian Poole on Michael Thomas. You're not going to put Brian Poole on Devin Funchess. You know what I'm saying? So it's one of those things where the Falcons definitely need some size, and a guy like Quentin Meeks in that second, third round range I think makes a lot of sense. Fourth round pick, I had Deidrin Sinnott. He was another guy that was an All-Star game guy, really shined at the East-West Shrine game. A 6 foot, 320-pound guy, short guy, but squatty, very powerful, squats 675 pounds. So you know he's going to get that big, broad jump with the lower body explosiveness at the combine. The Falcons are going to fall in love with this guy. So he's definitely going to be a guy, I think, is going to definitely be on the radar in this middle round range. If he tests particularly well, I think he could move up into the third round range. I don't really see him moving up higher than that, because NFL teams have this major issue with short defensive tackles for whatever reason. So I do think he's more of a third, fourth, fifth round type of guy. But he's the type of guy that I think the Falcons could wind up falling in love with in the mid rounds, looking for that nose tackle to deploy beside Grady Jarrett on rundowns. That one technique guy that Ataba Rubin was for the second half of last year. The Falcons don't have a fifth round pick. My sixth round selection was Darius Fountain, Northern Iowa kid. Good size as an outside receiver, decent speed. Be curious how he tests, but showed at the Shrine game. It was the offensive MVP in that game. Showed the Shrine game. He certainly had speed going against those Shrine game cornerbacks. We'll see sort of where his speed lies at. Ideally, you want a sub 4.5 40 for him at the combine next week. Showed some return skills during their practice week at the Shrine game. Had a 30-yard punt return in that game. And I do think the Falcons, when they target these wide receivers or these running backs that some people think they're going to target, I certainly think they'll look at a wide receiver in that third, fourth, fifth round range. I do think they're going to focus primarily on a guy that has both offensive upside but also return skills, so that they won't make the mistake that they made last year with Brian Hill. Not to say that the selection of Brian Hill was a mistake, but the management of Brian Hill was the mistake that we've talked about a number of times, where because Brian Hill couldn't carve out an immediate role in special teams, they didn't know what to do with him, and so that's why they kept a guy like Nick Williams on the roster over Brian Hill, because he can do that special teams role. And the difference between this and saying taking a player like Devin Fuller, like we did 2 years ago, the problem with Devin Fuller, no offense to Devin Fuller, who we'll see if he comes back this year and what he does, but Devin Fuller as a wide receiver was really nothing. He was an athlete playing wide receiver. He was a high school quarterback, got moved to wide receiver, really showed no development as a wide receiver over the course of his career at UCLA. And so he was more of an athlete than a real wide receiver. And so his upside to making the team was purely as a return specialist. He got injured, obviously. But I think the difference between a guy like Fountain is he has legitimate upside as a wide receiver. And so therefore, even if he doesn't win the return position, he can still stick on this roster because the Falcons are going to look at him as a developmental player, which is what they should have done with Brian Hill, but they didn't do. Seventh-round picks were Teron Johnson, a Weber State cornerback, Brett Toth, an Army offensive tackle. The Falcons have shown a lot of interest in Brett Toth. Scott Pioli was at an Army game in the fall checking him out. He was at both the Shrine game and the Senior Bowl. The issue with Brett Toth, I'll circle back to Johnson, but the issue with Brett Toth is because of the military commitment, the Pentagon, I think it's up to the Pentagon, passed a rule back in 2017. They changed it. Originally, this is how it was, and then they changed it to sort of allow players that go to the military academies, Air Force, Navy, and Army, that they could defer their military service and actually play in the NFL immediately and just basically go to, as I understand the rule, I don't know. But as I understand, they could just defer their service and basically be National Guardsmen while they were living out their NFL dreams. But they changed the rule back to that they do have to do the 2 years of military service. There's a possibility that they could make an exception to a guy like Toth, who some people think could be picked as high as a third or fourth round, which is much higher than any of these service academy guys typically get picked. And so they may make a special case of Toth and defer his military service. I don't think that's going to be the case. I wouldn't bet on it at this point in time, but we'll see. And because of that, I do think people consider him as a mid-round talent that could fall to the seventh-round pick, which, based off of the projection for the compensatory pick, is what I had Toth as. The Falcons, if those projections at over the cap are correct, the Falcons will have the last pick in the draft, Mr. Irrelevant, this year. And that's what Toth was. Teron Johnson was a guy that stood out at the Senior Bowl. He's a smaller guy, but has that sort of competitiveness. We'll see how he tests. I think that, but you know, sort of similar a little bit to who was the kid I liked that? What was it? William and Mary, Taylor Reynolds last year, who I thought was going to make the team, didn't even make it to camp. But reminded me a little bit of that guy in terms of more sort of projects as a nickel guy because he doesn't have ideal size and length that you love on the outside. But could be a guy they could develop behind Brian Poole for in a couple of years, play some special teams early on, and you know, 2-3 years down the road could really push for that inside slot spot as a role piece. but primarily just be a reserve guy. Assuming if the Falcons draft went as I projected it to be, you would have Meeks as your long-term nickel. But eventually, 2-3 years down the road, when Robert Alford is, like, you know, 31, 32, and is being a little bit pricey, and the Falcons are thinking, oh, we need to free up some cap space so we can re-sign, you know, the Grady Jarretts and the Deion Joneses and all these guys of the world to their second contracts. We got a young developing guy like Meeks up in the ranks who's now had, you know, 2+ years to develop as a potential starter. We can promote him. We can get rid of Robert Alford. You know, love you, Robert Alford, but, you know, you're going to be 32 years old. And, you know, you so much of your game relies on athleticism that at that point in time, there is a reasonable expectation that his play will decline at a certain point, 2-3 years down the road when he hits a certain age, as it often does for these, you know, Dante Robinson-esque cornerbacks. I know Alford is better than Dante. I want to make that clear. But similarly to Dante Robinson, he relies on his athleticism quite a bit. And so at a certain point, that's going to deteriorate and you're going to be relying on your technique and stuff. And not to say that Alford's technique is poor, but we know he's a little up and down there, a little inconsistent there. So I do think that eventually there will be a drop off with Alford. And that's when you sort of promote a guy like Meeks. And at that point in time, then you can look for a guy like Teron Johnson to potentially fill that nickel cornerback spot at that point in time. So that's the methodology going into my thought process with these picks. So go definitely check that out. I'm going to do another one probably in early March, right after the combine. Do another 7-round mock. I'll probably do another 1st-round mock on FalcFans.com. At this point in time, I'll probably do my NFL mocks on FalcFans.com that deal with all the NFL teams, whether it's a 1st-round, whether it's a 2nd-round with trades, all that type of stuff. I'll do that on FalcFans.com. My Falcons-specific mocks, I will just put on LockedOnFalcons.com. I know, you know, I'll probably cross-promote links on either site so that you don't miss those things, but that's probably what I'll plan. That's my plan right now in the offseason. We'll see if anything comes up and changes that. All right, we're running a little long. I'm starting to lose my voice a little bit, so I'll just answer one question. As I said on the previous Q&A last week, we had a billion questions from Riley Street. Yeah, this is Riley Street, and I'll just answer one of those because that means I don't have to answer it when I'm Locked On Falcons on a future leftover mailbag. That should be coming this week. I promised it this past weekend. My sickness has delayed it a little bit. Riley asks, any idea why uniforms across the board are so traditional in style and color scheme? I wouldn't be a fan of the European-style uniforms as I typically feel that they have too much going on and think the college uniforms like Oregon. I feel like teams could be a little more creative while still not having too much going on. The idea that comes to mind for the Falcons is one that I see on social media come through, where Sanu's number 12 jersey has an all-red, all-white, all-black version. I think there would be really nice choices. I know a lot of people really like the prime era all-black jerseys, but personally, although I appreciate them as an occasional throwback, I prefer a more modern uniform like we have now, or even maybe something a tad more modern for full-time jerseys. I like the all-blacks. I like the, you know, we're referring to the black with the black pants. The early 90s jerseys had silver pants just to differentiate between them. But the black pants is, you know, something that I complain about every year because the Falcons said, we're doing the throwbacks, but are they the all black pants, the ones with the black pants? And they're like, nope. I think I can't even remember the last time they did it. They did it many, many years ago. It seemed like maybe like 2010 or something like that. Probably was the last time it happened. And they haven't done it ever since. I like the color rush jerseys. I didn't like them at first because I wanted them to be the black, like the 49ers jerseys with the all black and then the red letters, red numbers. I think that should have been the ideal Falcons jersey, in my opinion. The 49ers, of course, had it. The Falcons had the all red with the black numbering with the white outline. And looking at it, you know, in the pictures of it, I was like, eh, it's okay. It's fine. You know, as far as color rush jerseys go, it's fine. But then seeing it actual on the field live on television with your own eyes, you know, it looked much, much better. It looked much cleaner that way. And that's, you know, that's always the case. Like you see people, you know, I'm into movies and whatnot. So you see people reaction to set photos and concept art for this character's, you know, outfit in these like superhero movies. And like, this is terrible and this looks awful. And then you see it in the actual movie. And it's like, it's fine. Like when you see people actually moving and stuff, it's perfectly fine. Other than that, like, you know, I look at, I don't know, Riley, whether we have a different viewpoint on what more modern jerseys. Yeah, I think when you're talking about like the Oregon, that is definitely that I would call those more postmodern than modern. I think when I think of modern jerseys, particularly when it comes to the NFL, I think of kind of like the Falcons jerseys, the Titans jerseys, the Bucks jerseys. Some of these jerseys that, you know, to me, what I think of more of a traditional jersey is sort of an all solid color scheme. And then they have the horizontal stripes on the sleeves. To me, the more modern NFL jerseys tend to do away with the horizontal stripes, and they have more vertical stripes, which is kind of what the Falcons have. Or they do something weird with the shoulders. They have shoulder stripes like the Panthers have. You know, it makes sense with certain teams because, like, the Chargers, I like the Chargers with the Thunderbolt, but that's more of a horizontal stripe. The Rams have, like, the Ram horn, I think, as the shoulder stripe. And so I'm not a huge fan of the shoulder stripe. I tend to be a little bit more traditional that way. In that sense. And to be honest with you, when the Falcons jerseys first came out, I guess that was like in 03 or 04, I wasn't a huge fan of them because of that reason. They look pretty much like the exact same as the Texans jerseys, except that they just swapped out navy blue for black. I wasn't a big fan of it then. I'm still, to this day, if you ask me, I'm not going to be like, yeah, the Falcons jerseys are awesome. I think, you know, they're probably in the bottom 10, you know, aesthetically in the NFL. But, you know, after 15 some odd years, they grow on you and you don't even really notice them anymore. So I'm going to take your question in a slightly different direction in terms of, like, should the Falcons get new jerseys? You know, I'd be cool with it, but at this point in time, I'm not necessarily, you know, pushing for it because it's not as if I'm too invested in it. It's just, for me, all I really want is every 3 or 4 years just to go, you know, when they do the throwbacks and they go with the black jerseys, just to throw the black pants on there once in a while. That's all I want. You know, you can do whatever you want. You can do whatever they do now, which is, I guess, is white pants. You know, you could throw some red pants in there like every once in a while. And I like the change. I like, you know, I got ADD. I like the change. So I appreciate the Oregon jerseys. I like the Oregon jerseys simply because, like, to me, I think the NFL jerseys do – they're trying, like, when they change up the sleeves and the shoulders, like, it's like you're doing something, but you're not doing anything. You're like, you're doing too much, but doing too little at the same time. It's kind of like this, like, let's throw some flash on the jersey. Like, the Bucks jerseys are horrendous with all that, you know, the pewter shoulder and sleeve. And it's like, that's stupid. And then having, like, the armpit stripe and whatnot on the Falcons jersey and the Titans and the Bengals and whatnot, it's all dumb to me. Like, to me, if you're going to do flashy, do what Oregon does and go all out flash. You know, if you're going to go all in, go big or go home. Now, I know they probably don't do that because it's probably the pricing of doing the intricate things like what the Oregon does with the reflective feathers and the webbing and all that type of stuff. I like that. Obviously, if you don't like it, the good thing that Oregon does and other schools as well that followed suit on this is it's a one-off. So even if you hate it, it's like, okay, they're having a different jersey next week. So it's more about a novelty thing than necessarily, like, we think this is the most aesthetically pleasing jersey to the eye, which it probably isn't. But I like the flash and novelty aspect of it. So that's my jersey take. I don't know if that was specifically the answer that you were looking for. But yeah, I think the NFL jerseys are so traditional just because it probably cuts down on cost. You know, it's just like, oh, let's just throw blue up there and we'll throw some red, throw some white, we'll throw some, you know, Packers is green and yellow and a little bit of white. And I think there's, you know, they pay homage to tradition and whatnot. And then, you know, the intricacies of doing these flashy, you know, quote unquote postmodern jerseys like Oregon and whatnot, probably just cost a little bit too much and probably would tick off too many people. And they feel like it would affect jersey sales. You know, I think they like the uniformity and whatnot. So I guess that answers your question, Riley. So that's it, guys. I hope you didn't mind my voice sounding scratchy. You probably didn't even notice it. But hopefully we will deliver on future episodes the rest of this week to make up for the lack of episodes in the early part of this week. Hopefully, the plan is to come back tomorrow with a guest to talk more Falcon stuff, and we'll continue our pre-combine coverage later in the week and talking around the league stuff if certain things come up. Josh Sitton just got informed today that the Bears will not be picking up his option, so he'll be a free agent. So if you're one of those fans wanting the Falcons to go out and get a veteran guard out there, he's very enticing. And as I said on Twitter last week, I would still take Isaiah Wynn in the first round, even if I did sign Josh Sitton, because, you know, between Mac, Sitton, and Laviche, they're all, what, 31, 32 years old? You gotta build towards the future. You know, you can't just rely on 31, 30. You know, all those guys could wind up retiring after this year, and you'd be stuck, you know? So that's how I view it. But and also I view, you know, having those three veterans, you know, going to work every day and teaching Isaiah Wynn and Wes Schweitzer and Sean Harlow how to be pros, I think is immensely valuable. Again, partially because I don't necessarily put a whole lot of stock in assistant coaches. Because, you know, like, I think, you know, having veterans on your roster helps, particularly at offensive line position, when you can learn technique and stuff and like that, and you can sort of see how it's done. And those guys can take you aside and show you some of the things that they know, in addition to whatever Chris Morgan and any other position coaches do. So I just think that's adding more fuel to the fire. So that's it, guys. If you want to submit questions, you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at FalcFans. If it's podcast related, just let me know. But if it is podcast related, you just might as well send in Locked On Falcons. That's the show's Twitter handle. If you don't have Twitter, you hate Twitter character limits, there is Facebook. Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. LockedOnFalcons@mail.com is email address where there are zero character limits. You can also leave a comment on LockedOnFalcons.com. Please, if you have thoughts on my mock draft, by all means, leave a comment there and let me know if you like it or you don't like it. Whatever you disagree with, go check that out on Locked On Falcons. But any additional questions, you can also comment there, as well as FalcFans.com. You can comment there. Those are the two sites where the show is posted daily. Stay tuned to both sites as we will come up with more content in the coming weeks. Certainly, I do want to get a combine primer up there early next week before the combine starts. And again, I do want to remind you guys that I do plan on posting some leftover mailbags the rest of this week on Locked On Falcons as well. So definitely stay tuned to that. And until then, guys, you guys stay locked on. I will be back hopefully tomorrow with sounding better and with a guest to talk more Falcon stuff. And if not, then we will continue the rest of this week with more combine stuff and more NFL news. Stay locked on. Stay frosty. I don't know how to sign these things off in the offseason, so I'm going to keep trying stuff until I figure out something I like.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.